Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of my Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 31st, 2017. This talk is on the Sundari Sutta, a sutta on the liberation of practicing restraint. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches that through restraint developed through the Eightfold Path, any conflict can be resolved while maintaining a mind of peaceful equanimity. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So if you have any questions while I'm reading this and commenting on it, just please let me know. And we'll have our comments and discussions when I'm done with the talk, just to keep it in context. So the Sundari Sutta teaches the peace gained, the unending peace gained through developing the entire Eightfold Path. In this sutta, the Buddha shows that restraint developed through the Eightfold Path, any conflict can be resolved while maintaining a mind of peaceful equanimity. The Buddha was staying at Anathapindika's monastery, Jeta's Grove, near Savatthi. The Buddha's reputation and those of the monks had grown, and they were much revered. They were recipients of much generosity and were treated with honor and respect by the local community. There were a group of wanderers from another sect that were not revered or honored and did not receive much support from the community. Being unrefined and stuck in self-referential views, they were envious of the Buddha and the Buddha's Sangha. One of their group was a young woman, Sundari. This unrefined group went to her and asked if she would do something to benefit their group. Sundari replied, "I would do anything, even give up my life, to benefit all of you." "Well, Sundari, we would like you to travel often to Jeta's Grove to make it appear to the townsfolks you are staying with some of the monks." As I get into this, you'll understand that everything the Buddha taught was in the context of Four Noble Truths and to develop an understanding of the three marks of existence. An aspect of dukkha, according to the Second Noble Truth, is craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha. You'll see all that in this sutta. But also you'll see how all of the Buddha's teachings were situational. So he's talking to the Sangha. Those of you that were on a retreat, you'll recognize this way of teaching and developing the Dhamma, that you're immersed in the Eightfold Path constantly. And so whatever occurs is related to the Eightfold Path, and so you understand the Dhamma in a direct and experiential way. And that's exactly how the Buddha uses this situation for a very profound teaching to the monks that were gathered. This is pretty early in the Buddha's teaching career, as far as I can tell. There's no chronological order of the suttas, but this seems like it's very early, so I doubt there are any nuns present. Go back to that one sentence. "Well, Sundari, we would like you to travel often to Jeta's Grove to make it appear to the townsfolk you are staying with some of the monks." Sundari agreed. Once it became well known that Sundari was apparently visiting the monks of the Buddha Sangha, she was murdered by the members of her group and left by the side of the road. This group, suffering self-inflicted confusion and delusion, then went to King Pasenadi, Kosala, and feigning ignorance and concern, said, "The female wanderer Sundari has vanished. We cannot find her anywhere. We think she may have gone to Jeta's Grove." So even during the Buddha's time, you know, you hear me say this often, that the Buddha's time was very similar to our time. And this is just a perfect example. People so deluded by their religious ideology justify killing one of their own just to make a point, just to further their ideology. And that's just what they did. King Pasenadi instructed them to go to Jeta's Grove to look for Sundari. They retrieved Sundari's body and mounted it on a litter to display to the townsfolk. From street to street they carried the decomposing body, shouting to all that could hear, "Look what the shameless followers of the Sakya-san," meaning the Buddha, Sakyan-san, the Buddha, "have done. Though they claim to follow a true Dhamma, they are evil and murderous liars." When the monks of the Buddha Sangha returned to the town on their alms round, they were reviled, insulted, and harassed. Returning to the Buddha, they recounted their experience. The Buddha reminded them of the Dhamma and then tells them to remain calm, as this difficulty will not last long. He's teaching them about impermanence. and after a week's time, this will pass. When you find yourself treated unfairly, remind those that they suffer greatly who continue ignorance and lies as much as the instigator. Both are the same and will suffer the same fate of long-term confusion and suffering. For the next week, the monks repeated this phrase when confronted by the misinformed townsfolk. Eventually, the reaction and disturbance in the minds of the townsfolk subsided, and they realized that the monks of the Buddha Sangha were innocent of any wrongdoing. The townsfolk then understood that they had been taken by those protecting and promoting a false Dhamma. After a week, the conflict ended. The monk said to the Buddha, "It is amazing, astounding. Having practiced restraint and speaking only the truth, the conflict is over." Just allowing your mind to return to a peaceful state and not reacting. They didn't have to go out and shout about how innocent they are or even attack the other sect. They simply followed the Buddha's direction and practiced restraint. They let their minds calm. They let the minds around them calm. There was nothing else to do. The Buddha responds, "Those unrestrained with no knowledge of the truth sling arrows at others like one at war. Those who have developed restraint through the Eightfold Path know to dismiss this foolishness and remain calm and remain with a calm and peaceful mind." A life of integrity, my words now, a life of integrity, a life lived within the integrity developed through the Eightfold Path, diminishes conflict when conflict arises. Living within the framework of the Eightfold Path provides the assurance that one's actions are harmless to others, even the ones that are instigating violence, even others that are using murder, murdering one of their own and putting it on you, even practice restraint there. The Sundari Sutta also teaches the comfort and safety that develops from taking true refuge in the Dhamma. The Buddha describes a profound right view of an awakened, fully mature human being as understanding, Buddha's words, understanding with regard to suffering, understanding with regard to the cause of suffering, understanding with regard to the cessation of suffering, and understanding with regard to the path, the Eightfold Path, developing the cessation of suffering. A mind that is resting in that framework of that understanding could not possibly react because you understand everything that's occurring. You understand the aggressiveness and the competitiveness of people around you, trying to establish themselves so they get the good food from the townsfolk. You understand where a deluded mind could lead. And even though it could be, and it would be repulsive in one sense to understand what took place here, you still don't react because you understand the importance of restraint, even at that point, even recognizing something as horrible as what occurred in this Sundari Sutta. The only possible reasonable response during the Buddha's time and 2,600 years later is restraint. It's the only thing that can lead to peace. And it's a peace that is grounded in understanding the nature of suffering, the nature of aggression. That's an awakened mind. When I describe an awakened mind, I describe it this way, fully mature. And isn't that an accurate description of someone that is able to practice restraint no matter what's occurring? And continue with my words. Developing the Eightfold Path brings a profound understanding of our own confusion, delusion, and suffering. Through this understanding, we gain understanding of others' confusion, delusion, and suffering. Through this direct knowledge, it becomes possible to practice restraint and remain disentangled from the events of the world and free of conflict. Maybe I shouldn't say this is the only way that can happen. I think it's the only way, but I'm not sure. There might be other ways that we can develop this type of profound restraint. I haven't seen them yet. And if there's one thing that the world needs today, just as like during the Buddha's time, is to learn this type of restraint. To understand why other people are acting in the way they're acting. And the only way we can understand that is to develop our own understanding of the nature of our own confusion and deluded thinking. To recognize and abandon the strategies we've created to ignore our own ignorance of, and a very specific ignorance, ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Because when we can no longer ignore the truth, when we're no longer ignorant of the truth, we can no longer act in that reactive way, in that competitive way, in that aggressive way. And in that way, just during the Buddha's time, we're models to the world. And the whole townsfolk changed. Without the Buddha Sangha doing anything but practicing restraint, the minds of the townsfolk around them change without any intervention or any interaction at all, just practicing restraint. But it's a profound restraint, isn't it? It's a restraint that is motivated by understanding. The Sundari Sutta shows the result of a well-developed Dhamma practice, the release from clinging and the resulting ongoing calm and peaceful quality of mind. It is through developing the Dhamma that it becomes possible to remain at peace with the people and events of life, including ourselves, as life occurs. You know, and that last line is important because we learn as we deepen concentration through right meditation, through using a meditation practice correctly to deepen our concentration, and we are able to start integrating the framework of the Eightfold Path, we learn the profound difference between acceptance and approval. And so we don't have to approve of what's occurring, whether it's someone promoting lies about us or something that's actually occurring that we hear about the news. I'm referring to what happened in New York today. We don't have to react because we accept it because it's what occurred and we understand why it occurred. Certainly we don't approve of it. And because we don't approve of it, we can keep our minds inclined towards awakening without reacting. And at the very least, we can develop peace within ourselves no matter what's occurring. But we've also seen that as we develop a calm and peaceful mind, we're able to extend that out into the world simply by not reacting ourselves. And we can also see that by reacting, we're inciting other people to react, aren't we? It's that restraint is such an important thing to understand that. Another way of recognizing restraint when we find ourselves with an agitated mind state, to remind ourselves that no matter what we've now attached ourselves to or are clinging to or wishing was different, to remind ourselves, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am, this is not myself. This is a reactive mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's tonight's talk. Thank you. So, any questions about this talk before we go around the room? Do you see any relevance to this talk? Actually, I didn't mean that to sound as flippant as it is. The reason why I ask that is just to reinforce that the Buddha's teachings were timeless, and the situations during the Buddha's time were exactly like they are today. Really, the only difference is that we're aware of things on a global scale like we never were before. So in that way, there's more emotional stress, I think. You know, but the solution is still the same, isn't it? To develop a calm and peaceful mind and understand the nature of dukkha in the world. Bob, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Yeah, the odd thing was this today I had to go and fix a situation that had gone pretty badly wrong several times. And the person who it happened to was getting pretty agitated. And I noticed that when I was on my way there, my mind wanted to head off in the direction of ill will, you know, and fantasize about all the bad things that could happen there. Mm-hmm. But when I finally got there and was in the situation, I automatically moved to, you know, right action and right speech. And that and it just diffused the situation right away. You know, even though the homeowner really wasn't trying to be easy, but it was. It ended up being such a natural reaction that it diffused it. It was still not an easy situation to deal with, but it took away the possibility of it getting worse.
Yeah.
Every time I have a question, you know, what to do, and it's getting to be automatic. You know, just follow, you know. Mm-hmm. Follow the right action and the right speech. If you get those two right, you're pretty much 90% there.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, that's such a practical example of integrating the Eightfold Path. That's how it should work. You know, in every situation, you can apply it. And in that way, right speech and right action does follow right view and right intention, and it's grounded in the other aspects of right effort, right mindfulness, and certainly right meditation or a well-concentrated mind, or you would have reacted. You know, it's all that one nice little package that works pretty well. Thank you. Judy, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you, John, and everybody else. I'm well, thank you.
Good.
Well, my meditation practice is going really well.
Okay.
The whole restraint thing, I see the value of that.
Yeah.
It's great. I don't really have too much more to say. Just continue. Most days it's good. Sometimes I still have the worry wolves at my door. But I'm pretty good at redirecting myself. So I see progress there.
Yeah. A lot of progress. That's great.
Mm.
Thank you. It's good to see you tonight.
Thank you.
Andrew, good to see you.
I think you've done at least one or more suttas on the subject of restraint in the past.
Yes.
And since then, including today's, it's just showed me that in situations that would normally flare up as a result of what somebody did or said or didn't do, I sometimes am able to restrain and sit back and speak correctly and not help to flare it up. So it doesn't happen all the time, but at least I'm aware of it now. So that's progress.
Yeah, that's great progress. You know, this is how we integrate the Dhamma. You know, a little bit at a time. There is a book that called Awareness by Anthony DeMello. It's a good book. It doesn't really relate to Buddhism, but I read it years ago, and there was a line in there I still remember. Awareness isn't change, but awareness is the power to change. We first have to know what we're dealing with, you know? And then we can move our mind. So good for you.
Awareness is the power to change.
Yeah. We have to have that. And so that's, again, that's a simple way of saying we need the framework of the Eightfold Path to know what we need to change. That's why it's there, you know? To recognize ongoing wrong views rooted in ignorance, to see it, and certainly reacting to someone. It's something rooted in wrong view. It's hard to do at times, though, isn't it? You know, but we a little bit at a time, and eventually we get to that place where a whole sangha is at peace. So I'm glad you're here tonight, Helen. Good to see you. How are
you? Thank you, John. Good to be here. Good to see everyone. You're welcome. I was traveling the last few days, so my meditation practice was interrupted in terms of time on the cushion, but. As we practice this more and more, it does become so integrated that just the way the language we have to express things can sort of almost like create a different atmosphere that other people pick up on, and then you see this sort of chain reaction of calm going through, and I just find that really powerful. And, you know, it's not like you have to, you know, blah, 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 Buddha this, blah, 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 Buddha that. You know, it's just by using the Eightfold Path and restraint and just reframing things and not expecting things to be any different than they are, because that doesn't change anything, doesn't move a mountain, doesn't move a mouse, doesn't change a thing. So because we live in a very reactive world where, you know, it's action, reaction, action, reaction all the time. You know, if you're just the calm in the storm, after a while, you know, that those vibrations go out and, you know, it's sort of like you can start a little tempest in a teapot with all this good stuff.
Yeah.
So I, you know, just practicing what I've learned here, I felt like there was a little impact around me, so it was nice.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. It is nice to see that what can grow from radical acceptance?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it really gets. I think people notice it because it is so uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why isn't that person aggravated or upset?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
excuse me, what, John, you said radical acceptance.
Radical acceptance. Yeah, it comes out every now and then. I think that's what it is. I mean, in spite. Having a mind that is at peace with no matter what's occurring is a mind of radical acceptance. You know, the Buddha was the biggest radical of his time and I think all time. But never in a confrontational way except when it was skillful to be confrontational. In other words, he lived by example. And that idea, what he taught, how he taught, the way that he lived his life was contrary to almost everything out there, especially the so-called spiritual or doctrinal systems of his time. He was a true radical. But he was a true radical not to be one, because he was teaching the difference between wrong views that were the common view and right view. So when you look at it that way, you have to be a radical to what's occurring, don't you? You're living your life in a way that is contrary to the way everybody else is living their life because you see life differently. And because you see life differently, you become kind of a peaceful radical. Did you need that little diatribe, or you just wanted to point out
Well, I was trying to make distinction between that and just acceptance.
Oh, yeah. So that's it. That's what I would say about that. Tim, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody. First of all, very grateful to the Dhamma and the Sangha.
Yeah, me too.
It's really helped my concentration going down this path. It's noticeable in my life. Especially during times like today or just with work or with family. It's nice to have the framework to fall back on to incorporate into the day because it snaps you back to go to your breath and recognize the situation you're in and what I'm saying and have, in front of the situation. And, you have the skills now to do right action and right speech and be appropriate to that situation. Regarding the sutta, the suttas are very, very, for me, sometimes they're very confusing because, of course, I think we get the idea, we get the gist of what's going on, especially if we look at it in a personal way. You know, when there's a confrontation on a personal way or even in a local way or even in a national way, you can understand it, but the thing I keep falling back on is some of the nature of human beings. And it's almost like if more people were like that, the ones that were doing the bad things would destroy us. If you look at the Nazis or Stalin, it's just confusing for me to incorporate what if we didn't do anything and accepted the Nazis and accepted Stalin. I'm not trying to draw any conclusions. It's just what goes on in my head sometimes. But it's a confusing sutta for me. I understand it and I agree. Turn the other cheek and don't react and show restraint and that is all. It makes total sense, especially on your own level of peace and tranquility.
You bring up a good point. I don't mean to cut you off, but you bring up an outstanding point, an important point. Remember the context. The monks or the Buddha weren't being attacked physically. They weren't in physical danger. The Buddha was one of the most sought-after advisors to kings and governors and other people in positions of power. And when it was appropriate, he never said no violence. He wasn't. He didn't practice ahimsa, which is a something that came out of the Vedas, a part of the Hindu modern Hindu religion. because he understood the nature of the world. There are times when you have to defend yourself. But he also left that up to kings and governors and other people in power. But he was entirely practical. He would be teaching the same thing today. He didn't teach something that was foolish, that would end up in you losing your life, because he understood that we need a life, we need a human life to develop awakening. But in every situation, he taught something framed by the Eightfold Path. So somebody asked, there was an inference of no such thing as a permanent self is often then taken to an extreme, saying, well, there's no such thing as a self. And that leads to this notion, well, if there's no such thing as a self, you don't even have to defend the self. So I keep bringing this up because it came up on retreat one time. This was the first or second retreat, and I just gave the sutta on the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the sutta on the not-self characteristic. And so the question arose, what do you do if you're standing on a train track and a train's coming at you? And the inference was, do you just stand there like a dope and get hit? No, you take two steps to the right. So thinking that we cannot defend ourselves or do anything to protect ourselves is an extreme view, isn't it? Situationally, the Buddha said, there's nothing here that threatens you. Practice restraint. Do you see the difference?
Yeah, I do see the difference. And you had actually mentioned it before. I made my comment about the appropriate reaction.
Yep.
The word appropriate. There obviously, you know, there are some times, but it's nevertheless, it's a line. It's a, where is the line? But I do understand. I mean, part of me almost feels sometimes when you're dealing, the more you deal with people, the more people you deal with, the more chances of something happening. And that's just life, you see.
Well, here's again, I don't mean to interrupt you. No. That is all described as dukkha. In the world, there's dukkha. That's everything from minor disappointment to extreme emotional and physical suffering, including great wars or great natural disasters. That's all part of it. The Dhamma is not... The Buddha never saw himself as a savior or his Dhamma as salvific, meaning it should solve all the problems of humanity. In fact, if he taught that, it would contradict the First Noble Truth, wouldn't it? The Buddha never set out to do that, to solve all the problems of humanity. The problems of humanity are common problems, meaning that they're common problems rooted in ignorance of the way things really are. Because of that, there's always going to be violence in the world. Because of that, there's always going to be natural disasters in the world. It's all part of it. The only thing that we have control over is how we think and how we react or respond to the world. So we can, again, take it to an extreme view, thinking that when you look at trying to make a strong correlation between what the Buddha taught and religion in general is the biggest problem with Buddhism, because it doesn't fit religions. Religions are meant to solve the problems of the world, whether it's through a spiritual type of governance through the congregation. We all decide to act a certain way because the leader, whatever that might be, a supreme being, says this is how we should act. And so that's a very good way to bring order to the world as long as people follow it, isn't it? To the Buddha, that's a confining place. That's something that is rooted in something that is unrealistic. What the Buddha taught is how to recognize the arising of dukkha in the world and how to bring cessation to our own contributions to our stress and suffering. So the things that you're talking about, the Hitlers and the Pol Pots and all the rest of them, and even you know, bring it to modern day, to that guy today, all of that is described in the Four Noble Truths, and it's described as dukkha arising from ignorance of the way things really are. Developing the Dhamma myself is not going to solve that, is it? But I can learn to live in peace in a world that is prone to ongoing dukkha. Does that help?
Yes, it did. Yes, no. It's,
so, yeah, and again,
I wanted some views on it. Just, you know.
Yeah, and not to beat the old dead horse. It's wrong views that would say, I can end dukkha categorically because it contradicts the first noble truth, so it's rooted in the wrong view. But the Buddha taught how to awaken on an individual level, and he described that in a few different ways. One was, an awakened right view is a view that understands dukkha, but understands it on such a profound level that we won't start seeking for answers to dukkha because we understand it's just what occurs in the world. Another way he described the quality of mind of an awakened human being is calm or at peace. Very simple, isn't it? But it's a mind that rests in the better word is equanimity. It rests in equanimity. It's always at peace, no matter what's occurring. But to go beyond that, how do I solve the problems of the world? How do I solve the Hitlers or the random ideologues that do things like what happened today? You can't. Part of living in the world. And that can be seen as an unsatisfying answer, isn't it? Until we realize it's simply the truth. It's simply what occurs in the world. I'm going to leave. I could go on. It's such a great and profound question. The solution to all the problems in the world doesn't solve all the problems in the world. It just simply extricates ourselves from it. We become disentangled from the world. But then in a very powerful way, we can contribute. So the Buddha brought a level. The Buddha minimized the violence in northern India and southern Nepal in that area during his lifetime and for many times thereafter. About 250 years after the Buddha's passing, King Ashoka was the ruler of most of India at the time. And he was probably one of the most brutal, vicious rulers of all time. That saying, he put a head on a pike, that was because of King Ashoka. Because when he conquered India was part of, there was tens, maybe hundreds of little kingdoms all around northern India. When he conquered another kingdom, he cut off their heads and put them on a pike. And all over India, there were hundreds of thousands of heads on a pike. That's what it looked like. This was the most violent human being probably the world has ever seen. He came across the Buddha's teaching, awakened, and he never harmed another soul. So much so that he's the first person to start universal health care 2,300 years ago. He developed such a level of nonviolence that he even started universal health care for animals. Something we're still trying to figure out how to do it today, aren't we? So the Buddha's teachings had a direct impact on the violence in the world, but it didn't solve the problem, did it? Great. Again, hope I didn't go too far with that, but thank you.
Thank you.
Greg, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, Jim. Something that seems to, I guess it's always present, but tonight specifically, is like this connection between the microcosmic application and like the macrocosmic.
Yeah.
And you said something earlier about how each... like each event in our life can be seen as how we should apply the Dhamma or the Eightfold Path, and it was like a mini little, sometimes things just click and it was like a little epiphany where like every instant could almost be, you could make a sutra out of it,
or, yeah.
Each little event could be a story, and I got caught thinking about that for a minute. Like how small it goes, you could really make a whole, they all kind of follow the same teaching pattern, the stories, and how like every moment can be a teachable moment of the Dhamma and the Eightfold Path. But restraint specifically, on our personal level, how it unfolds to the international level, the whole global level. Like this story seems like, what they call a false flag, where they were trying to actually put the blame on, they hurt one of their own to put the blame on the others so that they could justify, the attack against them, and that the restraint, I'm watching the Oliver Stone documentary it's called Untold History of the United States. And it really, you see how they feed on the reaction of people and this knee-jerk reaction, and how restraint practiced on an individual level really does explode into this, you know, global, because if people just allowed these little things to happen, and if they had personal restraint, like if every person had restraint, it would be a much different scenario. So yeah, we can't prevent the Hitlers, and you know, our individual action may not stop war and genocide in some way, you know, as the Dhamma spreads and as people react, because it can be used against you. It can be very easily manipulated if you have these reactions, because they're very predictable. So having personal restraint can amplify into this giant, I don't know, just kind of thinking these things. So if that makes any sense. The individual moments, like how small these little moments of restraint are, and how they can telescope into these, you know, enormous world events. And even tiny individual moments in history where one person showed restraint and saved the whole world from the brink of, you know, these stories about people having their buttons on the nukes and
Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, you think about how easily things could end. Restraint, like someone somewhere along the way taught this to the person, and or, you know, they just developed it by being around other people with restraint. So the way it spreads, and that's the end of that train of thought.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's a great train of thought. You got me thinking about a lot of things. Watch out. What should I talk about? How can I practice restraint in this moment? Let me talk about it this way. I don't practice transcendental meditation, but that's the first meditation method I use, and I have great respect for Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who started this. And the reason why he came out of the cave is because this is early 60s, might even be late 50s, when he started to get a feeling for what was going on in the world, and it so shocked him that he was afraid that we were going to blow ourselves off the planet. And he thought that if he could get enough people meditating, that he just might save the world from doing that, from annihilating ourselves. And that's why he started. What's developed in TM over the years is something unintended by the Maharishi. But I really believe that he succeeded. We haven't blown ourselves up yet, and we've come close. And I think that the Buddha's original and direct teachings have contributed to that. There's enough people that are practicing some level of realistic thinking that we haven't yet done that, and we do have an effect on helping to restrain others. Whether that's going to continue, I don't know. I can't predict the future. It's a pretty scary time, but again, it's a lot like it was 2,600 years ago. And not to take on my awakening to save the world, because that's getting into the bodhisattva ideal, which doesn't work. But at least I can develop my own level of peace and calm and stop contributing to what's going on in the world. That's all that anybody can do. Now imagine if nations really started learning the cause of difficulties, craving and clinging, and started practicing restraint. It really would change the world. But that's not the point. But it could happen in those little ways. The difference between the Buddha taught an eightfold path, the middle way between the microcosm and the macrocosm. It fits right in there. You know, it fits in the way that people live. And it's a path that people can develop, whether they will. I don't know. Thank you. Gail, so good to see you again.
Thank you. So good to be here. I missed it.
We missed you.
Oh, thank you. But I just lost my train of thought. I really like this reading. I thought it was very relevant for today. Mm-hmm. I thought it was great. But I was listening to different podcasts, or, you know, listening to different self-help readings and things like that, or social psychologist podcasts and things like that, And it seems like they all take something from the core of Buddhism or the core of the Buddhist teachings,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was kind of amazing. Like it almost seems like everything stems from that. And it seems like if this spread, it seems like it could really, it's so idealistic, but it could change a lot of things in the world and change
mm-hmm.
the way things are going and things like that. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. Thank you. But who knows if it's actually going to happen. It's up to us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how everything that I hear now, anything that has to do with self-help or anything like that, it all seems to stem from the core of Buddhism or from your teachings. And the teachings that I've come to.
Yeah, it does. The often the problem then is that the core teachings of what the Buddha teaches or what I teach is then adapted or accommodated in some way to fit a more modernized views, and often the real impact of it is then lost. Not always, but the more I understand what the Buddha taught, the more remarkable it is to me how it just fits every situation, and in the way that he taught to apply it fits every situation too. You know, there's always people that say, well, you know, this is 2,600 years later, we need to adapt it, we need to change it, we need to westernize it. There's this big push to... It's gaining more and more momentum that we need to westernize Buddhism to make it fit. They're noble truths. Noble, in this sense, means that they're noble and that they last, like a noble family maintains their position after generation. That's what noble means, that the truths are the same and they're applicable. And they're most applicable in their pure and direct form, not in an adapted form. And I learned that from just studying what the Buddha taught. Tim mentioned something before, that an individual sutta is hard to make sense. Even this sutta, it's hard to make. I mean, you can understand what it's about, but how to apply it in our lives, if you don't understand the context and what the Buddha taught, you kind of lose it. How do I apply it? But thank you for bringing that up, Gail. Good to see you. Carol, welcome to our Sangha.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions or comments about what's going on here?
No, not really. I'm just kind of taking it in, so...
Yeah, does it make any sense?
Yeah, some of it makes
good.
A lot of sense, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's also new.
It is. The what's important to remember is the Buddha awakened, he taught four noble truths. The first noble truth is that stress occurs in life. The second noble truth is that craving originates that stress and clinging to things, creating identities over things. Continues. The third noble truth that is that it's possible to end our own contributions to stress, which is kind of what we're talking about tonight. And then the fourth noble truth is that the Eightfold Path is the path for developing the cessation of our contributions to stress. So everything that the Buddha taught was in that context, everything that I teach is in that context, and every class has it. It's like this. We meditate, give a talk related to something that the Buddha taught. I only teach what can be found in the Sutta Pitaka, which is a preserved set of books that we know the Buddha taught. I don't teach anything else. It can seem pretty complicating and almost overwhelming at first, but over time, and pretty quickly, you learn to apply it into your life and develop a meditation practice. If you're going to start, I suggest start with very short periods of meditation, 2 or 3 or 4, maybe 5 minutes. And if you can do that twice a day, very quickly you'll have an established meditation practice. And if you join us here, you'll learn about the broader framework. So I hope you continue. There's a recording of this meditation on the website called Shamatha Vipassana. It's linked on the top menu under guided meditations. And there's a player that has different lengths of meditation from 5 to 45 minutes that you can download and listen to. But I'm glad you joined us tonight, and I hope
you
do again.
Thank you.
Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you, and really good to be here. One of the things that came up in the retreat was, I think it was from Larry, who said how appreciative that he came across John's teachings, because they are I almost said simple. I guess it's simple, but not easy, is what we keep saying.
Yeah.
The focus that John has on teaching this particular material is extraordinary, and I think a lot of us might have tried other things in our lives and got sort of lost and confused along the way. But this is, very helpful. So, I didn't mean to cry, but
it's all right.
I guess it was my turn.
I've done that once or twice.
And what Tim said earlier about, and I'll paraphrase from my point of view, is that sometimes it can feel extraordinarily passive by looking at the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And, you know, early on in my studies, I would say, yeah, but what about, you know, those spikes of temperament for emphasis, you know, or, you know, the ethnic response to living in an Italian family, you know. All those things that come up. But then you get to a point where you realize that if you follow the practice, you can have an even more profound effect on a situation if you use restraint.
Mm-hmm.
So I was playing around with the word courage today, and I was presented with a circumstance that was, you know, challenging, and so I was playing around with the word courage, thinking that maybe I had responded too passively to this situation that came up, and what's more courageous than what we're doing? That's all I have.
Thank you. I agree with that completely. I used to say, it's not like I don't say it anymore, I don't say it as often, that this is a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. It's really, you know, the things that we come up against. I used to think that I was much younger, courage is the absence of fear. Courage isn't the absence of fear. It's the ability to act with great mindfulness when you're full of fear, you know, in tough situations, but you maintain your mindfulness. So that's what a well-concentrated mind does. Thank you, Liz. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, too. Yeah, restraint is something I just have to keep practicing. And I think there are levels which it's easier to, you know, I can not take the candy on the counter, or I can see things that I can hold back from, and I can become a better listener. But it's the really big things, important things, particularly with people who you love or you're closest to, that, you know, that's where I think the practice becomes really, you know, there are often lots of places to practice, so seeing it, becoming aware, and acknowledging and being responsible for when I'm not restraining. And, you know, in my life, in the past, I come out like fighting around, you know, and then I pull back and say, oh, you know, so I'd like to be able to not have to feel like I have to, you know, defend so quickly and move to that it's okay, that it'll be okay, and get through it without having to, you know, like put my dukes up.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Kind of like what Greg was saying. To every moment is an opportunity to mm-hmm. practice a Dhamma. And if we've gotten to the point where we've already reacted, it doesn't mean we have to keep reacting. We can practice restraint at that moment, or the next, or the next.
You have
or the
to
next.
Be able to see it. I can't yeah. stop it unless I can see it.
Yeah, and that's where concentration comes in. Again, that's really the primary reason why the Buddha taught meditation, so we have enough concentration so we can see our own reactive mind. We can see the eye-making in this moment, and at this moment, practice restraint.
It's like what you were saying before, the awareness.
Yeah.
It's like part of the right view.
Well, Andrew said that, awareness. We have to have that. Another word for awareness is mindfulness. You know, what we're holding. Mindfulness means what to hold in mind or recollect. What we're holding in mind and what we associate with in that way is going to determine our life experience. And if we're holding in mind peace, if our thoughts are peaceful, they're selfless, there's no promotion of a self rooted in ignorance, peace prevails. It might only be in our own mind, but at least we have the opportunity to spread it. If it's not in our own mind, we can't possibly have an effect around us, can we? It begins with us. That's why metta begins with us. You know? That's why you hear me say often, you need to be very gentle with your practice. Because if you really want to be gentle with others, that starts with ourselves too. Great class tonight. The end result of practicing restraint is a mind of lasting peace and happiness. And it's not an excited happiness. It's a happiness rooted in peace, an ongoing peace. And it's a sure type of happiness. We know, you know, the Buddha often says, when you're awakened, you know you're awakened. And we've all had that experience, and I think every one of us described it to a certain extent, maybe Carol, but you will by next week. Even having a glimpse of that piece of an awakened mind, we've all talked about that. You know, we've all had that experience. And it's important to acknowledge that. We know that the Dhamma works, and it works in a very practical way. We know that it's through our own efforts. The Buddha always described himself as a rightly self-awakened one, meaning that it was through his efforts that he was able to awaken. It has nothing to do with what's going on in the world, good, bad, or indifferent. Has to do with how much we put into it in a correct way in the framework of the Eightfold Path. So that's all. Any other questions or comments about tonight's class? We'll finish. Our Dhamma dinner is on again, November 21st, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. There's info on Crossover Meditation website about what to bring and all that, but I think you all know, except Carol. Gail will tell Carol about the Dhamma dinner.
When you bring things to the dinner, do you bring it to the dinner, or do you drop it off somewhere?
Oh no, we'll have a table for gifts. Oh. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yep. And there'll be a table there for the dinner too, if you want to bring a dish to share. All that info is on the website. There's also a donation basket there for. So that we can pay Julie, who owns Love and Oven, so she can pay the help. For the first five or six dinners, she never even mentioned it.
She had her baby today.
She did? Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Boy,
so,
girl.
Boy, Otto.
That's outstanding. Well,
that's so cute.
Maybe she'll make it to the dinner then. Maybe it'll be the coming out for Otto. So, donations just so we can help pay the kitchen staff at Love and Oven. And also, I'll buy paper. They asked if I would buy plates and plastic knives and forks and some cups and stuff and water. So I'll do that out of donations. There's a basket out there for that. I think that's it. We'll finish with the Buddha's words on metta. I also want to remind you, if you haven't already, if you found my book outstanding, please do a review on Amazon. I'm going to keep bringing it up. If you want me to shut up about it, you know what to do.
I'm working on revision 3 of mine.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Just keep spicing it up. You know? If you want me to help you, I'll just... I really would appreciate it. I want to put buy some advertising, so I'd like to have some positive reviews up there. We'll finish with the Metta Sutta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.